This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. All right, today we're just hitting the record button and we're going to see what happens. A couple days ago, I set out the feelers. I put the feelers out on Instagram and I was like, hey, yo, ask me some questions. So like a listener Q&A type of episode, and let me know what you think. And so, or ask me some questions. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty straightforward. This is another shoot from the hip episode. I really haven't looked at these per se. I've gone over them just a little bit, not in depth in some of the questions. So I'm just going to kind of go down the list here and just have a good old fashioned BS session with you guys about some of the questions that you've asked me. I've looked at a couple, I should say, and there's a couple, you know, some of them are hunting, some of them are not hunting related. And I feel like it's a good time to do it. I have my upcoming knee surgery here tomorrow, actually. So when this episode launches, I'll be in surgery. If you download and listen right away, first thing in the morning, I'll probably be in surgery. And I'm getting a total knee replacement, and that kind of leads me to my first question here. And so we'll get right into it. And that is, when is the knee surgery? I just asked that or just answered that. That's, on Wednesday this week. And then, are you excited or nervous about it? I think I'm a little bit of both. I'm excited because I'm like optimistic towards the future. This year in South Dakota was a bit brutal. Walking on uneven ground, walking up and down the hills, like going through the terrain and trying to, like, if I shot a deer, man, it would have been brutal trying to get it out. My knee was stiff all day. It was sore. It would take me like 5 or 10 minutes to get it up and moving freely again. And then I went right into the whitetail season when I got back, climbing up and down tree stands. I twisted it, lots of pain there. And that's when I was just like, dude, I need to get this scheduled and just get it over with. And so I'm canceling my future hunting trips or Western trips until further notice. And I actually had a conversation last week with the gal who's going to do my physical therapy. And I asked her the question, you know, we were talking about recovery time and she was asking me like, you know, what kind of activity levels do you have? What are you looking forward to? Like, why are you getting this? Those types of questions. And I just simply responded to it with, do you think that I will be able to climb up in a tree or use a ladder or, you know, do one leg type of things going into this upcoming October, November? And she's like, I don't see why you couldn't. You know, I've read horror stories about these knee replacement surgeries. I've heard really good things about them as well. I've talked with guys who have gotten them. I've read stories about people who wish they, you know, got them when they were 50, wish they got, you know, would have had it when they were, you know, 45, about my age. And so a lot of that led me to just pulling the trigger on this surgery. And my only fear or anxiety would really be if I come out of it and do the proper rehab, which I will, do the proper rehab, work on everything, and it still causes me problems or it prevents me from doing certain things. And so I'm trying to get full mobility back into this knee. I'm going to go through whatever it takes to get that, hopefully. And I'm glad I got it now and not in 10 years, because the next 10 years, like if I'm 55 and I'm doing this, then it's going to be one of those things where, my quality of life, I'm really going to have to slow down, like walking on uneven ground, playing, being a baseball coach or a wrestling coach, things like that. Some of that like wrestling stuff may change a little bit, but my gut tells me if I do it right, then I'm going to be able to, come back and kind of live, get back into the swing of things. I know it's going to take probably 6 months, but that's why all the activities that I love to do take part in the fall. I wanted to do it early spring. Actually, I wanted to do it earlier than that, but now, is the time. Tomorrow's the day. I just want to get it over with and start rehabbing so I can get right into it. Right. I know I'm probably not going to be running marathons. I'm not going to be squatting 400 pounds anymore, that kind of stuff. I just want to get it done so I can start walking without a crutch or without a cane or things like that. And get back on the horse and live the best life I can. And I think that's the goal here. So great question. Thank you very much for that. Before we get into the next question, I think what I'm going to do is send a huge shout out to the partners just really quick. If you're looking for, in my opinion, one of the best broadheads, expandable or fixed blade, go check out wasparchery.com. I do have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Vortex Optics. Turkey season is coming up fast. And I think you should get a red dot on your turkey shotgun. So go check out vortexoptics.com. They have a full lineup of optics, from binoculars to red dots to rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, all that stuff. Vortexoptics.com. Next on the list is Code Blue Sense, real and synthetic deer urines, mock scrape kits, scent elimination products. Go to CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Reveal Trail Cameras. Some of the statistics they're sharing with everybody now about how many users and how many total images are sent through their servers in a day blows my mind. And that tells you that a lot of people are using them and a lot of people are happy with the service and the product. So go check out tacticam.com/cameras and check out all of the cameras from Reveal, as well as the their app. You can download that on Google Play or wherever you download your apps, the Reveal app. So go check that out. And last but not least, my company, Full Sneak Gear. I fixed the shipping issues with that. So if you want to go and order a shirt, we got turkey season coming up. Go to fullsneakgear.com, buy the turkey t-shirt, and it's pretty badass, man. So go check it out. All right. There's the commercials. I appreciate all of those. I mean, one thing I like about the partners that we have over here is their participants. And what I mean by that is everybody who works for the company in some way, shape, or form actually hunts or is actually involved. Some of the bigger companies that I've worked with in the past that are not necessarily, they're marketing towards hunters, but they're not necessarily a hunting product. Some of those get real tricky because then you're dealing with a marketing person who doesn't know what a buck is or doesn't know what the term full draw means, or you know what I mean? And then it's hard to have conversations with them about, you know, oh, how can you promote our products? Well, I can talk to my audience in detail. Well, I don't know, whatever. And so I'm just glad that all the partners that I work with are in it. And I appreciate that. So it makes talking to them a lot easier. All right. Next question. And I'm going to just kind of run through these. The next question is, would you hunt whitetails in Ontario? Not as complicated as people suggest and great access. Okay. I've been asked to hunt Canada multiple times, and at some point in my life, I would absolutely love to go hunt whitetails in a different country. I would love to go hunt Canadian whitetails. I can remember back in the day listening to not necessarily listening, but watching ESPN, and they'd have hunting shows on there. and those guys would be up in Canada in Saskatchewan, and it's like negative 55 degrees outside, and they're sitting in some like heated little blind with a heater in front of them, and every breath is just, you know, the white beards and things like that, and some giant bodied Saskatchewan monster steps out and they drill it. And so, yes, I think about that type of stuff a lot. It's just this stage of my life. Where am I at in this stage of my life? Cause I, believe it or not, I turn down hunts every year, for a couple reasons. One, the fall is busy. Hunting season is busy for me, especially I coach football, I coach wrestling, I coach, baseball for fall ball. I coach, those three sports. And then also I'm trying to get out and hunt too. And usually I go on my Western mule deer hunt, South Dakota, or I go on an archery elk hunt, in September. And so with the age of the kids that I have, I am, I'm in a spot now where I'm just trying to be as balanced as humanly possible. And I would absolutely love it. I want to get to Canada and hunt caribou, at some point in my life, or Alaska, or, I mean, there's still a lot of species that I want to hunt in North America, but I also want to, at some point in my life, maybe go check out and see what Africa's all about. Right. But right now it comes down to balancing family and hunting in the fall. And, I think that there's a lot of opportunities in the States that I feel like I should try and accomplish first before I go, spend the time getting up there first off. And then second off, spending any type of money to get to where I need to get to. So, it's a time, it's an energy, it's a balance, it's a financial thing. And it kind of all adds up into what I'm, you know, my goals as a hunter. But if I had unlimited resources, I would definitely be dropping into Canada every once in a while and hunting all different types of species. So, you're not the first guy that has asked me. So I am, I'm glad you asked that question. The next question. Now you guys have heard me talk about this buck in the past. And the question is, do you still think about shooting shipwreck high? Okay. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with this buck, I named Shipwreck. In 2007, I had my first encounter with him. He was probably a Boone and Crockett 3 or 4 year old, 170 giant. Just, he came right up into my stand and right underneath of me. He was behind a tree. I didn't get a shot. A lot of things happened. And, that started this journey between me and this buck. And long story short, I chased this deer for 5 years and had him at, I had him at shooting, like before November 5th, 2010, I had him within shooting range a couple times. It just didn't work out. I saw him on the hoof multiple times. It just didn't work out. Lots of close encounters, lots of trail camera pictures, lots of, being mobile. And that's, I think, one thing that I learned about chasing this buck is how to be mobile, the importance of access routes, wind direction, cutting the wind, all of that stuff. And one buck kind of over a 5 year period taught me these things. And so it was crazy that I had this buck to go chase, because I feel like I shouldn't have. I passed up a lot of opportunities of deer standing right in front of me, between 2007 and 2010, even into 2011, that, were chip shots on like 150 class deer that I just did not take because I'm chasing a once in a lifetime buck. And, but I don't regret it. And so I chased this deer for several years. I kind of kept it fairly tight between me and a neighboring landowner, and then me and a guy, my buddy Todd, and we like it, he was on his property sometimes. He was on my property sometimes. He was on the other landowner's property sometimes, and he was running this circuit. And I spent years. I mean, I spent 5 years of my life from 2007, 8, 9, 10, and 11 is when he was shot by the neighbor. I went after him, and I went after him hard. And I slipped up. I don't know if I ever got directly busted by him, which I think is why he stuck around that farm. But he was just the pinnacle of mature buck movement, mature buck behavior, how he walked the terrain, like how other deer reacted to him. The crazy thing about this, I'm looking back at this now, I never saw him in the area of another buck. Meaning, you know, sometimes when you're deer hunting, there's a buck you're chasing and he hangs out in a group. Or maybe he's in an area where there's other bucks and they mingle back and forth. Every time I saw this buck on the hoof, he was by himself or he was following a doe and never running. This buck never ran other than the time that I shot him. So absolutely crazy journey with that particular buck. And now getting back to the specifics of the question, do you think about shooting him high? I think about it every time I climb into a tree stand. November, my 30th birthday, November 5th, 2010. I went into this gigantic oak tree in the middle of the CRP field. Imagine a square and lines drawn to the corners so it creates an X inside this box. And there's a giant oak tree right in the middle of this X. And I sat in this tree because I felt like this is a lot of movement coming in and out. About 7:30, 8 o'clock, I rattled. And then at 9:18, I think it was, he shows up and following the tree line in the waterway in this CRP field. And long story short, he's right there. And I drew back. He's at 22 yards. He drew back. I drew back, released the arrow, chip shot, right? Chip shot. Hit him high. I followed blood for 2 days, didn't find him. Had a lot of people help me find him, look for him. He jumped over. I followed blood to a fence crossing. He jumped the fence. And I did not see him again. Okay. Then I went to the landowner. The landowner said, "Hey, if there's blood, you can follow him." And I knew the guy, great guy. And, there was no blood. So I was like, "No, I'm not going to follow him." And, long story short, he showed up next year and I didn't see him. I got one trail camera picture of him in velvet. And then nothing in September or September at all or throughout the entire summer. But then I got a phone call from that guy and he's like, "Hey, I just want to let you know last night I shot Shipwreck." And it was like the first cold front in October. It was the 18th. I believe it was October 18th is when he shot him. And I was very happy for that guy. But that's a buck that taught me a lot of lessons, how mature bucks behave in a variety of different scenarios and weather patterns and how they just move through the terrain. And I wish that there was a way that somehow I could have documented that more precisely in a way to share with you guys. And maybe that's what I'll do that. Maybe this summer sometime, I'll have a week where I break down, like, what did Shipwreck tell me? And kind of go into all of the, that's a great idea. Actually, I'm going to write that down. Go into all the ways that I learned from this one particular buck, when he moved, how he moved. And, because quite frankly, October, this buck just was a ghost. And I mean, I don't mean ghost in the sense that he wasn't there, because I knew he was there. you just have this gut feeling, this hunter's intuition, this woodsmanship that tells you these rubs are not made by a 120-inch 8-pointer, right? These rubs are made by giants, aggressive scraping. You know, it almost seemed like all the other bucks on the farm were skittish too. Like they knew who was in charge. They shouldn't be here, that kind of stuff. So that's Shipwreck. I think about him every time I climb into the tree stand. I actually do that a lot. I think about all the deer that I've killed every time in the tree stand, because there's a lot of time where I like to be on my phone a little bit, but and play some games to like when it's in the morning, like if it's too dark to see anything, I'll just maybe play the block game on my phone. But I think about the strategy and all the bucks that I have on my wall right now. I think about shooting them, why I shot them, where I shot them, how I shot, like all that stuff. And so I think about them quite a bit. So, next question. Oh, get out of here. Here's a question. I'm in the process of quitting drinking. What do you miss most about drinking? That's a really good question, man. And today, actually, March, I'm April, I think it's, yeah. So May will be 1 year. So I'm 10 months with no alcohol. Okay. I've gotten to a point now where I don't miss the drinking that much, but here's what I do miss. And it's more like nostalgic. I went to a couple Iowa football games this year, and you get the whiff of the grill and the brats and just the people, the vibe and things like that. And I instantly started craving a beer. And I don't necessarily know if it was the actual beer or if it was just the environment itself. And it doesn't necessarily have to change that much per se, but I don't know. I don't really miss it, but I miss sometimes the environments that drinking put me in, like a bar with your bros, watching a football game, right? And maybe that's not necessarily an alcohol thing, but I miss the younger version of me that could handle that. Maybe it's the younger version, maybe it's the time thing, but I obviously don't miss hangovers. I don't miss having to pay an additional $40 when you go out to eat, because my wife used to drink like $10 martinis or mixed drinks, and I would drink a couple old fashions, and then that's $50 right there without even eating yet, right? And so I don't miss that. I think another thing I miss, and I was thinking about this a couple days ago, the thing I miss about drinking is, like, you remember, it's never night drinking. Like I don't miss going to a bar at night, but I miss like the day beer, if that makes sense. I miss having a beer while I'm cleaning my garage. Like I would have loved to crack a beer and drink a couple beers while I'm was cleaning my garage this weekend and organizing that. I would have loved to had a beer while I was sitting down watching wrestling this weekend. I miss like the bro, and I think it might just be the bro aspect of it, where it's like, all right, boys, let's go, boys. You know, like go tailgating, or like I still go tailgating, but it's not like it used to be, right? Everything's way calmer now. And I think I miss that youthful aspect of it, but I understand now that the youthful aspect leads to the pain and suffering of the hangover, right? And so, I think it's just acceptance, right? Like I can't run marathons anymore because I'm fat, I'm out of shape, and my knees are blown out. I can't bench press, you know, 350 pounds, 400 pounds now because my shoulder's junk, right? And I don't know if it's me missing it or if it's the youth aspect of it. But yes, there are scenarios where I do miss a good cold beer. Not so much I take that back. The other day I was walking down the street and I smelled somebody smoking a cigar, and it instantly brought me to bourbon for some reason. Cause I used to sit on my back deck and smoke a cigar and drink a little bourbon. And so it's the moments maybe that I miss. But I definitely am trying to live this healthier lifestyle now. And I don't know if I necessarily I don't miss it as much as I did 6 months ago, let's say. Okay. When I was first giving up drinking and I was just like, ugh, I want a beer. I want a beer. I want a beer. But then you get past a point, and for me, it was fairly easy. I just was like, why? I don't need it anymore. I don't need it. And I don't think I'll ever need it again. Right. I don't want to, like, I'm not the guy that will say I'm never going to do anything, because something might, you might. Right. I'm doing this for my wife too. She's also quit. So I'm not only doing this for me, I'm doing it for her, and I'm also doing it for my kids, because I feel like me quitting drinking shows my kids, not just me telling them and drinking a beer, stay away from alcohol while they drink a beer, but now they're seeing, and now I can have real life conversations with them, especially my daughter, dude. I was in seventh grade, her age. Holy shit. I was in seventh grade the first time I had alcohol. First time I ever got drunk was in eighth grade. And so she's in that stage right now, getting into that stage right now. And I want to be completely blunt and upfront with her and let her know, like, dude, I almost died in a car wreck because of it. Actually, you know what? I don't know if I've ever done this. Give me a second here. Especially, I want everybody to go to YouTube if you get this. Let me see if I can find it. I have this book here of all these pictures. Oh, yep, here it is. And my dad took this picture. Senior skip day, I went to my buddies, or we went to a farm and in high school, and we all got drunk. Older brother bought a whole bunch of kegs of beer, and me and my, we spent all day drinking there. My buddy's girlfriend went to a different town. She went to a different school, and they were having their senior skip day at another place. And so me and him got into a car. He was driving, and we decided, hey, let's take the back roads to this town and we'll go visit her and her friends. Well, if you're on YouTube right now, I want you to look at this right there. We rolled this truck, his 1990 Ford Ranger. I'm looking at it right there. And you see how the window is pushed in like that? We hit a sign, a caution sharp turn sign. And that sign went between the window, or through the windshield. It went between us. Imagine if that sign hit somebody, they're dead, right? Went through the windshield, went out the back windshield, or out the back windshield. And then it landed in the bed of the truck. I should have died that day. Should have. And you just saw the pictures. If you're on, if you're listening somewhere else, go to the Nine Finger Chronicles YouTube page and you can look at the picture there. But now I can share that picture with them. I can be like, hey, listen, it ain't worth it. If you're ever in a spot, like, I like this rule that I heard from a dad once, and it was like, you just send me an X, and I'll come in and I'll be the bad guy. I'll blow the fucking party up. I'll just ride your ass. And that way he can go to his buddies. Dude, I'm sorry. My dad is such an asshole and he doesn't look like the loser. Right. I'm going to tell that to my kids. If you're ever in an uncomfortable situation and you want somebody to come get you out of it, I'm that guy. I don't care where you're at. I don't care what time of day it is. Holler at your boy and I'll come get you. So that's the kind of trust I want my kids to have in me. And I feel like if I'm truthful with them, like, hey, listen, you know why I didn't go to college to play football? It's because I thought drinking was more important than football, right? I thought there was a lot of opportunities in my life that I didn't get to go do, especially when I was in my 20s. Like, just imagine how many hunts I could have gone on if I wasn't bellied up to a bar, right? You can't change your past. I had a lot of good times. I met a lot of good people in that time frame. But still, it's like, what could have you have done if you were sober? You could have built something. You could have accomplished something other than just destroying, you know, your liver or whatever it is. So small parts of it I miss, but for the most part, I'm kind of over it. Next question here is, what's something you're most proud of that you've done for the hunting industry? That's a good question. And I don't know if I'm the person who gets to answer that, to be honest with you. I think that's for everybody who's been following me for the last 10 years. The people who enjoy listening to the podcast, what do they think that I've accomplished for the industry or for or the community over the years? As far as the industry, like, I'm a believer that there is the community and that there is the industry. All right. And so as far as the Sportsman or the Nine Finger Chronicles is concerned, when I started it because I felt like there were more people out there than just the hunting celebrities who had something to say. The hunting celebrity, the YouTube stars, the Instagram influencers, things like that. I didn't grow up with any of that, right? Maybe the television shows, yes. But as you start to get older and you understand that the style of hunting that a lot of these people do, and I'm not saying all of them, because, you know, guys like the Hunting Public, they're grinders. Right? They're public land movers and shakers. And on some of their videos, they hunt some private land too, but they're relatable. They're more relatable to me than some of these highly managed deer hunting properties that are, the amount of time and energy that is put into them is for one reason. It's to grow the biggest antlers possible. And you get that through trigger control, age, nutrition. Right. And so that's something that I just could not relate to. And the thing, and the reason why I started the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast all those years ago is because I knew guys. And of course, I'm talking about Iowa in the heyday, Illinois in the heyday, Wisconsin, southeastern Minnesota, northern Missouri, right? In the primo times of year, I knew of the decade or whatever you want to say, early 2000s, late 90s, relatives who were getting the job done, doing way less, right? And having more real lives than the quote unquote hunting celebrity did. And I was like, everybody wants to know what this guy does, but this guy's not telling the whole story. He's not saying things like, I spent $20,000 on diesel fuel. I spent, you know, and I spent, you know, I have 350 acres of managed ground or 1,000 acres of managed ground. These people are like, I got 70 acres. You know, I hunted this buck on 70 acres. I got off of my, third shift, all of that. I worked third shift. So I went right into a morning hunt and I knew this buck was there. They're still serious hardcore deer hunters, but they have real lives as well. And that's where I wanted to tell that story and let everybody know that, man, I hate to say it, but hunting was the blue collar guy's activity all along, right? It's always been the blue collar guy, and the blue collar guy, gets the job done with limited resources. And it's not always about the giant antlers and things like that. And I also think that it's becoming a rich man's sport, or I don't even know if rich is the right word, but it's becoming an activity where if you want to have a certain type of experience, you need to have access, you need to have money, and you a disposable income per se. And I feel like that's going away. I feel like that's going away. And so I wanted to tell everyone's story, not just the hunting guru or the hunting celebrity or the YouTube star or things like that. I wanted to get, you know, real stories from real people. So, outside of that, one thing that I also feel like is that the voice of the common guy when it comes to how the deer herd is managed is sometimes swept under the rug. So I wanted to, you know, through speaking with conservationists, through biologists, through, you know, the Department of Natural Resources, I've interviewed a ton of those guys over the past year, and I'm proud that I got to be the person to ask some of these questions, some of these devil's advocate questions. Excuse me. And so ask a lot of these questions where, you know, that maybe we're not getting, you know, maybe we're not getting asked however many, you know, years ago, right? It was just, you know, there's a difference between education and entertainment. And I think there was a lot of people looking at entertainment and trying to turn it into education. Well, if you're watching someone hunt on 1,000 acres of highly managed ground, what are you going to take away from that? They have an unpressured deer herd. They have tons more resources, and they have older age class bucks running around their farms. How can you relate to that? How could I relate to that? I couldn't. So that's why I was doing what I was doing. And I think, although there was times I felt like I maybe went off the line just a little bit to check some boxes and say, okay, well, I've interviewed this person, or I wanted to do something maybe that somebody else has already done, but add my little flair to it. I've done that a couple times, but I think the thing that, if I'm talking about myself, the thing that I'm maybe the most proud of is that I am myself, right? And what I mean by that is, take a couple of the last podcast episodes, for example, where me and my guest talk about pooping for the entire episode almost. And so it's that kind of reality that I want to listen to. Like, I feel that's funny and interesting. I also like learning and knowing about certain things, you know, whether it's public land or private land or biology or statistics or guys who kill big bucks or guys who live in high pressured states that, you know, still get the job done, or venison or gear. And that's why I continue to do what I do. But I'm the thing that I'm another thing that just popped into my head is the listener base of this and the amount of messages that I get in a given week where people reach out to me and they say, dude, I really, really like your podcast. Thank you for what it is you're doing. And you don't have to talk about deer hunting every single day, every single episode. You don't have to do it. And I'm trying to do that. And so I'm proud of the fact that I'm getting these messages from people. That makes my soul smile, I guess you would say. And so, shout out to all the people who've reached out to me. I really try hard to get back to everybody. And if I missed you, I'm sorry, but, those are a couple things that I'm proud of. Okay. This is a question, because usually there's two parts to a question like that. Here's the entire question. Would you give up all modern technology advancements in hunting, camera, maps, drone? Usually there's like a if or a but at the end of that. So would I get here? Let me just tell you this. Here's what made me start killing bigger or older age class deer is a trail camera, straight up. As soon as I got a trail camera, I knew what I was missing. I saw what was out there, and I started passing smaller antlered deer in hopes of killing one of the bigger antlered deer on the farms. Straight up, trail cameras did that. Mapping, right? The only reason that I'm able to go where I am able to go when I go out west or in Colorado or in Idaho is because of Onyx, right? They've opened the door. You know, and those type of mapping companies have opened the door for guys like me to experience a different species. And so my first hunt I ever went on, that was paper maps. And I got section maps from Nebraska. Or back in the day, I always had a plat map in my truck. And you'd flip through the little areas of your county, and you could see roads and you could see landowners and things like that. And would I give it all up? I mean, if it got outlawed, I would definitely give it all up. I've never used a drone for anything. If all of a sudden it became illegal to do, yeah, I'd probably do it. And to be completely honest with you, not right now, because I feel like there's some things I want to check off. But as of right now, I'm trying to get my kids into hunting. And I think trail cameras are going to play a role in just deer movement. All I care about is like, okay, there's deer in these woods. When I, you know, before we go out into the hunt, I want to check a couple trail cameras, see if there's deer on those trail cameras, and then set up in a spot where my kids can go. For me now, it's less about trying to locate big deer and more about putting my kids on deer. So, that's one thing. Drones though, here's what I'll say about drones. It's ridiculous what they're doing with them now. Scouting properties now, looking for deer bedding with thermals, man, I don't know. I feel like anytime I talk about it, I'm a hypocrite. As far as the technology usage, because I use cell cams, I use trail cameras, I use the digital mapping. I don't use drones. And I'm always thinking about, where is the line? Is there a line? Whose job is it to say where the line is at? Can you use cell cams? Can you use drones? Should you use drones? Should you use digital maps? Should you use cellular trail cameras? Should you use crossbows or thermals or any of the other technology that's out there? And I honestly, it's something I think about a lot, and I don't know if I have the answer for that yet. So this is something that I'm always thinking about. But here's what I'll say when it comes to advancements in technology. If I had my way, would you rather have it continue to keep going to the point where, you know, someone could be shooting a deer from their house, you know, through an app, through a trail camera that has a gun attached to it, that kind of stuff? Or would I like it to go back to the days where there's no electronics, there's no range finders, I didn't have a range finder. You know how I knew a tree or a bush? Actually, here's what I did. One of the first times I went hunting, I had paint sticks that stir the paint, and I put numbers on them, and I would hunt in fence lines, and I would take 20 steps, and I would put a marker in the ground at 20 steps. I would take another, 10 steps, 30 and 40. And that's, I never used the 40 because I don't even think I could hit a bale of hay at 40 yards, but you get my point. Like, that's what I used to do. It was all steps. steps. And so I would almost rather have hunting go back to a non-electric, non-technical technology side than have it advance so far that the success rate of it starts to impact access for people because everybody wants to buy up the ground, or it starts to affect the wildlife and hunting becomes so successful. Like hunters, because of technologies, hunting becomes so easy that it affects the natural resource. And right now we're in the middle of that. And so I'm always thinking of that. So I wish I had a better answer for that, but, I don't know, man, it's something that I think about, and I don't know if it's necessarily something for me to say whether someone should or should not do it. That's up to the Department of Natural Resources. That's up to the state, that you guys live in. It's actually, it's the state legislators and who makes some of these rules and regulations and things like that. Special interest groups, whether how much input they should or should not have in the natural resource. And so, be sure you guys are aware of those things, because there's certain animals out there right now that are in jeopardy of being politicized instead of having the Department of Natural Resources do tests and research and get statistics about how many tags should be allocated, what weapons should we be using, and things like that. So something to keep up on and something to think about. Now,
if you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill at its lowest price ever and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first and only GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Based on advertised cash price for 30-day supply of medication only. Membership required. Fee not included, and billed separately. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
All right. What is your favorite Jetboil meal? That's a great question. My favorite Jetboil meal would be... there's a couple of them actually, and they're, let me pull it up. I'm going to pull up one, right? Actually, I'll do it on my laptop. It's right here. Let's see. Peak Refuel is one of them. Peak Refuel. Oops. Peak Refuel. And it is I think it's called Sweet Pork and Rice. Shop now. Meals. Okay. I'm just going to run through some of the ones that I've had from Peak Refuel and let you guys know that. Okay. Chicken Alfredo, money, delicious. chicken teriyaki and rice. Delicious. One of my favorites is chicken pesto pasta. Delicious. By far, heads and tails above all of those from Peak Refuel is sweet pork and rice. That is hands down my favorite. Now, there's some other ones here. Let me see if there's any other ones worth talking about. Nope, that's it. The sweet pork and rice from Peak Refuel is my favorite. Now, let me go to Heather's Choice. That is a packable meals, similar to that, freeze-dried meals. Let me see the full menu here. There was one. I think it was bison chili. Yes. Grass-fed bison chili. That one is delish. I've had that one when I went to Colorado on an elk hunt. Let me click on that once. I might actually have to order one. Yes. So grass-fed bison chili. That one was absolutely delicious. And then the other one that I had was the spaghetti with marinara sauce from there. And I think that's it. Yeah. So that's one that stands out. And now, because I have to, I'm going to go to Mountain House and let you know a couple of my favorite Mountain House meals, because I do still use a little bit of Mountain House, but I only use them when I have Mountain House freeze-dried meals. Oh, here we go. I do eat those whenever I have the ability to, have fruit with me. So I wouldn't take a Mountain House on a backcountry hunt because I'm probably not going to carry apples or something. But anyway, okay. My favorite. So here's a couple. The beef stew, good. Chicken and dumplings, good. Fettuccine Alfredo is okay. The beef stroganoff is okay. But hands down, and I mean hands down, and this might be up there for one of my favorite meal, like freeze-dried meals of all time, is the Mountain House chicken fried rice. You give me the sweet pork rice from Peak Refuel and the chicken fried rice from Mountain House, and I could eat that all year long. Very delicious, very delicious. And that's really all I eat. I don't typically eat a freeze-dried meal for breakfast when I go out there. The spaghetti from Mountain House is okay, but I'm looking here now and they have a lot of stuff that I don't have, that I've never seen before. So they got something called a pro pack. Anyway, those are my favorite, freeze dried meals for the jet boil. So, let's see here. Next question. Okay. There's that. Next question here is let me start at the top here. Here we go. If you had to pick one deal breaker sign that makes you walk away from potential hunting spot immediately, what is it? I would have, when I first started hunting, I would have said another truck, or I would have said seeing another person walk in. But I think that's been one of my strategies for my entire life, is knowing where the other hunters have been and then flanking their position and taking a guess or an estimate or a educated guess on where they were going to be. Meaning like, okay, I'm watching a guy walk in. That means downwind to him is screwed. All right. What are these deer going to do when they smell him? Are they going to come my way? They're going to go around. And so I've really tried hard to learn how to flank other hunters. So as far as that being a deal breaker, I've had to learn, because like over the course of the years, as farms have been sold hunting public land. What are you going to do? Just not hunt? I've had to find ways around that. So a hunter isn't necessarily going to make me walk away from a spot unless there's a ton of them, a ton of hunters, or they're loud, or they're, or I watch maybe a target buck get up and run away, something like that. Now from a strategy standpoint, let's say I'm going into an area with a run and gun, you know, whether I'm hunting out of a saddle or I have a stand on my back, and I'm going into virgin ground, fresh sign, don't know, never been there before. And I get into what I feel is a good spot based off of terrain and wind direction and access. And I'm not seeing deer sign. And what I mean by that is I'm not necessarily interested in scrapes or rubs. But if I don't see the proper amount of tracks that I feel like I, it's not necessarily a one thing. Like if I go into a property and I'm not seeing the sign, or I'm not seeing like, it's like an equation, right? If I don't see fresh tracks, if I don't see like some rubs, or even some scrapes, you know, it's like a hodgepodge of all of those things that give me, is the wind doing what I want to do? Like, I won't go into an area if I think the wind's going to screw me, especially if the thermals are wrong. So I take a lot of pride in my access routes. So I guess the thing that I've learned the most is dogs, man. Like, one thing that would probably be a deal breaker, for me, especially for not like the next day, but for a property that has wild dogs running in it. I've been affected by dogs multiple times throughout the course of my hunting career, I guess you'd say. And they're not going to change the course, the annual course, or forever, but they will change the course of a deer for that particular hunt or that next morning potentially. So natural deer movement's kind of out the window at that point. And so maybe I would go away and not come back. What makes you walk away from a potential hunting spot immediately? What is it? I wish I had a better answer, man. It's mostly my gut. Another thing that I kind of have learned over the years is after the farmer picks the corn or beans and they turn the soil over and disc all the corn underneath of the ground, that's like a wasteland. The deer aren't necessarily coming to that too much anymore because they have to work too hard to get everything out of the ground. And so I would say that that's another thing that, especially in farm country, so lack of sign. And now back in the day, I used to hunt that. I'd still hunt. And I would wonder why I didn't see any deer. Well, it's because there's no sign, there's no tracks, there's no food, right? There's maybe the cover's wrong, maybe there's dry, there's no water. A lot of things kind of add up into that decision. So there's that answer. All right. Here's a interesting one. For someone, maybe this person has maybe some medical issues, or they're getting older. For some reason, or for someone transitioning from tree stands to ground hunting, what is the biggest mistake you see people making in terms of concealment? Well, I think it's very obvious. And that is, I'm not a huge fan. I don't believe, I don't necessarily think you need the best possible camo. I think camo doesn't necessarily hurt anything, but it's not a game changer when you're hunting elevated. Where does camo play a big role is if you're hunting from the ground. Then I think it becomes extremely important. So I would say concealment is important. Maybe learn how to make a mini ground blind. Maybe find ways to use a ground blind in your hunting strategy. Camo is going to be more important. I would say that camo's more important. I would say that obviously, and here's the biggest one, movement. You should not be moving if you're hunting from the ground. You're going to, especially if you're bow hunting, like gun hunting, maybe, you know, this isn't a huge conversation, but if you're trying to go from elevated to being on the ground, you got to learn how when to draw your bow back. When the deer's head's down or it's behind a tree or it's looking a different direction. I know that when I've hunted from the ground in the past, and mule deer have taught me this lesson the hard way, drawing back is what gets me almost every time. Coming to full draw and then maybe even trying to creep over the ledge or drawing back when they see me, they have such a huge range of vision that you're not, if you're in the wide open and you're trying to draw back on them, they're going to see you unless you're like directly behind them or there's something blocking their body is blocking their field of view. But I would say that less movement and more concealment, ground blinds, really. Okay. Next question. How has your approach to e-scouting changed over the last three seasons? Are there specific features you look for now that you used to ignore? I don't know if I ignored them, but I think over the last 3 years, satellite imagery, LIDAR, and topo lines have become more precise, to the point where you can start to see minor terrain feature changes and not just the major, like here is a giant washout or here's a big valley or drainage or a ridge. Now it's so good, you're able to see little small bumps in terrain. I call those spur ridges. A spur ridge is something that it's like a little terrain feature that leads up a main ridge or coming out of a bottom up into something that, I a long time ago on the Sportsman's Empire, YouTube page, I did a whiteboard whitetails or a whiteboard Wednesdays or something like that, where I would draw topo lines on this whiteboard and show the deer movement and show what you can and can't see based off of the e-scouting and things like that. So I would say that for me, what's changed the most isn't necessarily the places I'm looking for, but now I can see more precisely what it is I know that I'm looking for. I'm looking for these very small terrain features within bigger terrain features. So you've heard the term the spot within the spot. So I'm looking for that. And then basically I'm taking that information and I'm saying to myself, okay, based off of all the other, based off of everything else that I know, the principles I've learned, what I've learned in the past of how deer move through specific terrain features, what is the wind direction, that type of stuff. How am I going in to this property? What's my access route going to be? How can I get to that spot when the wind is in this direction? Is it cloudy? Are the thermals going down? Is it sunny? Are the thermals going up? That kind of stuff. And so that is what e-scouting has helped me do, is just become more precise in locating these places. And 3 years ago, the technology just wasn't there to show that. So I'm just able to look for more features. Okay. What is one piece of conventional wisdom in the hunting world that you found to be completely false through your own experience? So I'm going to answer this in two parts. I'm going to kind of twist this question a little bit. My own experience. Okay. Number one, completely false. What's completely false is the fact that back in the day, I used to think that if you shot all these little eight pointers, you know, you used to have quote unquote management bucks. there's no such thing as a management buck. Okay. There's no such thing as a call buck, right? You and expect then all of a sudden your genetic lineage in your deer herd to change to only spit out 10 pointers or have a drop tine or some stuff like that. So we know that that's false through science. Okay. Also, false, completely false. I guess maybe some of the gear, like the Acorn Cruncher. I can remember back in the day, before, like, they would sell anything. They would sponsor, like, guys would sponsor anything. The Acorn Cruncher, the Deer View Mirror. There's a couple other products out there that I know I'm missing. And they were just like, I can remember I bought an Acorn Cruncher. Someone gave me an Acorn Cruncher. I didn't buy it. And I'm like, I'm going to see if this works. And I had like three deer working their way in. And I started slowly and softly working this Acorn Cruncher. And this mama doe puts her head right up in the tree, looks at me, blows for 10 minutes, and then takes off and runs. And I'm like, well, that's the last time I ever used the Acorn Cruncher, right? So products, I guess products would be something that's completely false. Like the era of people trying to get away with something is over now. So, I've only used my own experiences to hunt, right? I don't look at someone else and go, well, you can't do that. That's false. So great question. I'm a bit stumped on actually how to answer this one. I'm going to read it one more time and maybe it'll come to me. What is one piece of conventional wisdom in the hunting world that you've found to be completely false through your own experience? I would just say pressured properties, right? Back in the day when I used to watch some of these shows that would be over like these big, highly manicured clover fields. And across it, you would see, or CRP, you would see these deer, you know, come in, they rattle and they're on a straight rope right to you, right? Or guys being able to get away with stuff in the tree and you got like unpressured deer herds. And so then I would go out and try to implement some of those same practices on pressured public or pressured private, and it just would not work for me. So that might be one of them. Okay. The next one is, what is one piece of gear you've owned over 5 years that you refuse to replace and why? Two come to mind. Well, there's several that come to mind. But number one, my Arctic Shield boot covers. They have allowed me to continue to stay ultra mobile in cold weather and not need to wear big rubber boots straight up, right? I don't need to like clunk around in my big boots. I don't need to worry about climbing up in a tree stand, and getting, you know, slipping off because the foothold is too small for the boot. The rubber boots get cold. They're not as insulated as you think they are. They're not meant to sit in cold weather and not move, right? The rubber gets cold. Your feet are going to get cold. End of story. And the Arctic Shield boot cover has kind of saved that. So, the next piece of equipment, that I probably, you know, I don't say that I'll ever do this, but who knows? Dude, I love Vortex Optics and I love my binoculars and I love the fact that you can smash the shit out of them. They'll break. And I've had to take care of the, advantage of their VIP warranty through a spotting scope, binoculars in the past. And just the people that worked there are grade A. And I don't know if you have a piece of Vortex equipment, why you would ever want to, right? With the VIP warranty and the customer service, there's no need to go anywhere else. That's my opinion. And then let's see here. What else? My Wasp broadheads are a product. Oh, I know. wasp broadheads, obviously, but my arrows. They're not a paid partner. Day Six arrows are amazing, and it is something that I have confidence in. I know the guy who owns the company. I know how critical he is about what type of product that he wants to bring to market. And he stands by his products because he's the one who's building the products, right? And that's Day Six gear, man. And so go check out the Day Six arrows because I'm a huge fan. They're expensive, but they're expensive for a reason. It's because they're the best. I don't like to spend money on a lot of things, which actually leads into this next question, but I'm going to spend money where I feel has the direct. So I'll put it to you this way. And here's a little bit of my thought process on this. I draw back. I let an arrow go. I want that the first thing that hits, that is correcting, that is driving, that is aiming that broadhead, which is a wasp broadhead that I am very confident in. I want whatever's pushing that to be of equal quality. And so I found that Day Six is that, and that my arrow setup is the thing that I think about the most. I have four fletchings for a reason. My arrow weight is a certain weight for a reason. The length is a reason. The head is a reason. There's a reason for my entire arrow build. And I can't say that about everything else that I hunt with, but it is that setup is the thing I think about the most and that I'm the most critical about. And so I want it to be the thing that actually kills the deer. I want it to be the thing that I'm the most confident in. So there's that. In an era of $1,000 saddles and tree stands and high-end camo and bows and arrows, do you think the barrier to entry for hunters is getting too high? How do we fix it? Financially, here's what I'll answer to that. Financially, I'm not worried about the gear because there's always a secondary market. You can go to Facebook Marketplace. You can go to a bow shop, and there's going to always be somebody who's willing to sell you a used bow, used camo. So I think the barrier of entry there is reasonable. The barrier of entry to hunting is access right now. Where are you going to go hunt? If my neighbor across the street said to me, "Hey man, I want to hunt. I want to learn how to hunt. Where do I go?" I'd say, "You need to go to public land." And then he's going to run into public land and he's going to cut his teeth on public land. And it's actually probably going to make him a better hunter, but he's going to fail a lot of times. But does someone who wants to get into something want to fail all the time? No, they don't. And that's why, I know my neighbor is not my kid. But my kid, I want to make sure they have an experience that they're going to remember, that they want to come back for. And then as they get older, I can say to them, "Hey, listen, I want, you got to learn. You're going to fail. Now I'm going to let you go on your own. I have to set them up for that." And I think for let's just go with the adult onset hunter, the new hunter that's an adult. I think really the only access is. The only barrier to entry is access. You're either going to have to travel for public land. There's not a lot of places, and I'm speaking for Iowa because Iowa doesn't have a lot of public land. There are certain counties in Iowa that if you live in those counties, you don't have public land. You got to know somebody or you're going to have to travel. And so that's where I think the barrier of entry comes. I think that there's plenty of used equipment. And if you're anything like me, you have totes or gear that you don't even use that you could pass down to a new onset hunter who asks. I've given like 3 bows away in my entire life to people who are interested about getting into hunting. So, there's that. This is such a good question. Is there a specific piece of tech or apps, cameras, or optics that you feel have actually taken some of the fun out of the hunt? I don't think cell cameras have crossed the line. I used to think maybe they did, but I don't think they do. Do cellular trail cameras have the ability to be used in a way where you can walk out your back door? I mean, obviously you still have to make the shot. So knowing the only part of it that I would say is, for the most part, I know every deer on the farm. By the time I hunt in late October or November, I got a good idea of what's running around. There's very little surprises anymore. Back in the day when I would run SD card cameras, and I still do run SD card cameras in river bottom, in the river bottom ground. But what I mean by that is there is a lot of there's a lot of people who are probably using them like this. You know, they're waiting on their couch. They're able to pop on their e-bike or their back, on their side by side, roll out to the farm real quick, get down there. I mean, there's been influencers who have done that where, oh, I got to leave for a trip. And then they get a ding on their phone. They grab their rifle. They run down the lane. They shoot the buck and there he is. Right. I don't know if that for me is a fun way to do it. I don't get to do that because I don't live close enough to any of the farms that I hunt that would allow me to do that. So, I think hunting is what you make it. And we've had these conversations before about hunting. If you don't like cell cams, don't use cell cams. If you don't like crossbows, don't use crossbows, right? If you don't like a certain rule and regulation, well, kind of tough shit, unless you're going to rally the troops and talk to the Department of Natural Resources or your legislators about it. But as far as gear is concerned, I have fun every year. And this year, all of that tech that I still use, the trail cameras, the apps, I still shot 125-inch, 120-inch, 8-point buck, and I had a blast doing it. And so I think fun is what you make it. It's not the gear. Don't let the gear determine whether or not something is fun. That's it. That's all I can say on that one. All right, we got a couple more here. Ooh, here's a good one. What is the most unexpected thing you've learned about the hunting community since starting the Nine Finger Chronicles? Unexpected would be, man, I feel like it's probably human nature, right? But I still think that the hunting community is at odds with each other about some very frugal things. What I mean by that is, I don't like the term hater. So for example, I've voiced my opinion about not having crossbows in the archery season. That's my opinion. That doesn't mean that I hate you or that I disagree. I guess it may mean that I disagree with you. Doesn't mean that I hate you. It doesn't mean that I don't think that crossbows have a place in the hunting community, because I strongly believe that they do for kids and, you know, people who can't pull back compound bows, things like that. I do not believe that a crossbow is a bow. But here's what I will say is that that's my opinion. And if you have a different opinion than me, that's great. I'm not going to hate you because of your opinion. I feel like I've passed that point in my life where I'm just like, oh, you piece of shit. You piece of shit. You shoot a crossbow, dude. Like, I'm past all that, man. At the same time, right? Like, there's still a lot of divisiveness. And for some reason, like, guys who hunt with dogs, guys who hunt with over bait, guys who hunt with, you know, whatever the rule and regulation, if it's legal, do it. And there's people who are doing legal things in certain states that's getting a lot of hate. And it's almost like the hunting community is just a little bit bipolar. Now, the next part that kind of is unexpected is the amount of generosity and willingness to help that I have seen since I've started the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. People inviting me to their farms, and I don't take them up on that because I'm like, dude, if there's a big buck on your farm, I want you to shoot it, right? Why don't you go shoot it? You know, there's going to come a day where I might be saying yes to those. So be careful if you invite me, because I might be coming. But, you know, some people that I've met over the course, it's unexpected, because there's people that I text weekly that I've met through the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast and that I communicate with on a weekly basis that I have never met in person, or people that I've met through the Nine Finger Chronicles that I go on hunts with now every single year, right? And so the generosity, the willingness to help you drag a deer out. I could make a post. I need help dragging a deer out, and somebody would show up for me. I know it. Whether it's a friend that who already knows me, if it's just a random stranger who I've never met before, I would 100%. The generosity, the kindness, the passion that most of you guys have for the wildlife, how good of people you are for the most part, right? There's scumbags in every circle, but yeah, just the kindness that people have, the generosity, like, sending me homemade coffee cups. I had a guy, his wife makes homemade coffee cups, sends my wife coffee cups. My deer mount this year downstairs, my Euro mount from this year's buck, is on a plaque of an outline of Iowa that someone made for me and sent it to me. That's generous, man. And I appreciate that. And the world needs more people like that. And so, that's a little bit unexpected to me, and I'm thankful for that. Next question. How do you balance being present during a hunt with the pressure of needing to produce content or stories for the show? There is no pressure here. I do not, and that's why I stopped filming my hunts. I'm going to get back into it at some point. I just know it, because I feel like there's additional stories to tell. But I don't feel pressure pulling my phone out and talking to the phone about what I'm going, because I'm not trying to produce the end result, which is killing a deer. I'm trying to show the reality of deer hunting. And so I'm not necessarily like, there's no pressure for me. None of my contracts that I'm in with any of the partners or potential partners say that I have to kill X number of deer every single year in order for me to continue to use their products. That's not what I do. I am showing the truth. And the truth is, sometimes hunting can suck ass, and sometimes it can be immaculate and powerful. And so I don't feel any pressure to produce anything. There is a little bit pressure on the podcasting side of things. Of what type of content I should be talking about. But I just try to be me as much as humanly possible. And that's why you get podcasts that talk about 80s movies, 80s toys, 90s rap, pooping, that kind of stuff. And so no pressure. I just love it. And that's why I've done it as long as I have. And I've given up that search for being wealthy and rich to do what I love. And that's this podcasting, the Nine Finger Chronicles, the Sportsman's Empire, all that stuff. So no pressure. Who is your dream guest, dead or alive, that you'd love to sit down with for a 2-hour deep dive? Ooh, deep dive. Deep dive. I don't know if he's as into it as any of us are, but I've always wanted to have Bo Jackson, the football player. You know, if I had to say one person was my idol growing up, I would say it's Bo Jackson. From the sports side of things. And then when I found out he was also a bow hunter, holy shit, I was like, now he's even higher up on my list. And so I think it would be cool to have a conversation with someone like Chris Pratt, right? Chris Pratt lives in a weird space where he loves hunting, but he also relies on Hollywood to make his money, right? And so I have never been in a spot where if I post a dead animal on Instagram or Facebook that I would get a whole bunch of backlash from that. I don't understand what's that like and how it could possibly affect my, outcome, right? My job, my, you know what I'm talking about. I guess like 2 hours is a long time. I would love to sit down with, I don't know, maybe a historian and talk about what the hunters in North America were like a couple thousand years ago, right? How they hunted, what tools they used to hunt. Did they just scare a whole bunch of buffalo off a cliff and then that's how they hunted? When did hunting become about sport versus, you know, eating and feeding yourself? So there's that. I mean, Fred Bear would be a good one to have on. Just thinking out loud here, some of the people that I've tried to get on the show. Oh my God. I watched him a lot on ESPN when I was a kid. He's the grand slam holder. I cannot believe I'm buffing on this dude's name. World-class bow hunter, has killed everything in Africa and North America with his bow. Damn, dude. I don't know. So those are a couple like, and then of course, Tony Peterson, right? I could sit down and have a really good deep dive with him. A 2-hour deep dive. Maybe we'll try to make that happen this year, towards summer. Personal and what if scenarios is kind of like this next little, I've kind of organized them in personal and what if scenarios. If you could only hunt one species for the rest of your life, but you had to do it in a state you've never visited, where would you go and what are you chasing? One species for the rest of your life in a state I've never been to, where are you going and what are you chasing? This is going to shock people. Dude, mule deer hunting is so much fun. It's so much fun. I would probably move to Wyoming or North Dakota and try to hunt mule deer. Maybe I would go to Colorado and hunt mule deer, high country mule deer. But there's something about like the prairie, the open plains, that type of environment where these big mule deer live. So I'm going to answer that by saying mule deer in Wyoming. I've never hunted in Wyoming before, but that's where I want to go hunt, and mule deer is the species that I want to hunt. What was your most humbling moment in the woods? Not a missed shot, but a moment where nature put you in your place. That's a great question. When did nature put me in my place? Well, I think when it comes to hunting, I've been humbled by big mature deer my entire hunting career. They're in charge out there. You're lucky if you, the better you get, the more lucky you get. But because you still need that whitetail to walk right next to you within, especially for bow hunting, right? But when it comes to humbling moments, man, I would say a humbling moment is me calling when I shouldn't have called. Me thinking that the wind was, I was safe in a tree stand, and then a big giant buck getting downwind of me. That sucks. That really sucks. Humbling moments, like basically where my ego, where I said I'm better than the deer, or I'm better than, or tougher than Mother Nature. You know, Mother Nature can humble you real quick in with its weather, right? With her weather, whether I am hot and I think I can handle it. I mean, there's been a couple times where I hiked and I said, it's going to get hot today. I'm going to hike out in the dark in South Dakota. I went way far and I chased deer. The sun came up and then it got to like heat index of 102 that one year. And I didn't pack enough water and I had to hike like 2 miles back to the truck. And I was almost getting ill because I was so hot. On the other hand, I'm going to pop out. I'm going to be fine in just the clothes that I'm wearing. And it gets extremely cold. Weather moves in. Your feet get cold. Your fingers are cold. You're underdressed. You're trying to fight Mother Nature. Or for another example would be in colder temps, but another example would be in Colorado saying, well, I don't need to get prepared too much to go on these hikes. And then you get out there and the mountain destroys you. That's when I feel humbled, is when mostly when Mother Nature's involved, because you can't beat Mother Nature, man. It's impossible to beat her if you're not taking the proper precautions. So humbling moments have all been through like nature related, not necessarily a missed shot. How do you handle the postseason blues once the tags are filled or the clock runs out? What keeps you occupied in the off season? And this is an easy answer, man. My kids, man. I love my family. I love my kids. So it's easy for me to transition back into to handle the full time, you know, the postseason blues, because we got baseball, we got wrestling, we got fishing, we got mushroom hunting coming up, we got turkey season. So if you're in it, right? We did shed hunting a couple weeks. So what we got here is this, it's never really, I actually almost bought a couple raccoon hand traps, you know, the kind where they have a tube and they put their hand down in it to grab the bait and it clamps down on their arm or their fingers. And so I thought about getting a couple traps. Right? Just staying actively outside, shooting your bow, going through your gear, cleaning your garage, doing this podcast. Man, one of the reasons I started this podcast was to mitigate the postseason blues. And so I get to talk about hunting all day, every day. And so I love it, man. So I really don't have a lot of postseason blues, right? There might be some moments of regret where I would have said something like, dude, I should probably shoot this doe, and I didn't, right? That kind of stuff. So, yeah. Off season. Let me see. Oh, where are we at here? And I think that's it. I think I need to check one more place real quick. But for everybody who has, for everybody who turned in all of their, you know, questions, man, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to do that. I'm going to check one more spot here. And we're going to go here. Ooh, I think I got a lot. Checking one more spot. Yep. Let's see here. Sorry about this. Cool. I think that's it. That's where I'm going to end it today. So I am, I'm thankful for all of you guys who have, turned in the questions. Thank you very much for that. Huge shout out to all of the people, who listen and download. Man, I can't thank you enough. Really, your attention gives me life, if that makes sense. And so, I'm very thankful for that. If you're feeling down, reach out to someone. If you're feeling up and you're fired up about something, reach out to somebody. Call someone who you haven't talked to in a long time. If you get an opportunity, maybe check out the Bible. Read into that a little bit. I'd start at Matthew. Be disciplined in your life. That's something that I feel has maybe lacked a little bit in my life, and I need to get back on more of a routine in several avenues. I would say be participants in your county or your state as far as providing information to the natural resources, getting involved and it at a local level. It doesn't have to be some nationwide conservation effort, but at a local level, there's all sorts of local level stuff going on that benefit you directly. Outside of that, just try to be a good person, man. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Wear your safety harness, and I'll talk to you next time.